Welcome to The Journey, a chronological study which goes through Scripture from Genesis to Revelation in chronological order.
And Luke 14 begins with a familiar story. We've seen this a lot. It happens a fair amount. They're trying to trap him. The only option, one of the only things they can ever do that even suggests, he's so careful about the law, frankly, and so careful, even in his radical nature, to obey both Roman and Jewish law, that there's really nothing ever they can pin on him. And the one thing, though, that they keep trying to pin on him is that he's breaking the Sabbath, and by healing people and helping people on the Sabbath. And he keeps pointing out to them that's not how the Sabbath works. He actually keeps saying not just that he can do whatever he wants on the Sabbath. He says something like that once. He says that, you know, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. But most of the time what he says is just that he is keeping the law of the Sabbath and they don't understand it. They are mistaken about what you can and can't do on the Sabbath, and that helping people is always acceptable on the Sabbath is kind of what he says. And he's right. He has Levitical law to stand on for that. There's actually a lot of talk in Leviticus about helping your neighbor get their donkey out of the pit if he falls in the pit, you know. And so even if it's just helping your neighbor with his animals, you don't let that animal or that neighbor suffer for the Sabbath just because it's Sabbath. So here we go. So we're going to see a story, another one where they're just kind of desperate to figure out how to catch him. On one Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, and again, we've pointed this out before, and I just think it's a really important point to remember. Jesus, as much as he is opposed to the corruption and the illegitimate authority and the self-righteousness of many of the Pharisees, it doesn't mean that he despises the Pharisees. He spends time with the Pharisees. He eats in their there are many stories which begin this way, when he went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, which tells you, number one, that some of them are okay having him come, and some of them are okay, and he's okay eating in their houses. So he really is surprisingly cordial with them. He's at parties with Pharisees, you know, specifically almost as often, it seems, as he is with sinners. So he isn't, you know, his bias doesn't flip just one way or the other. He keeps trying to reach out to the Pharisees as well. And when he doesn't, he says, it's because you keep saying you don't need me. So presumably the houses he goes to are people that he thinks there's a shot that they might still listen to him. So this is one Sabbath. Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee. He was being carefully watched, but here he is. He's in the house, and they're watching him, looking for something to trap him with. There in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and the experts in the law, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? So he knows he's being watched. He knows they want to trap him. So he's just going to say, look, what's the law? You keep trying to catch me for healing on the Sabbath, but you tell me, is it lawful or isn't it? And by kind of coming straight at them with this, they're kind of forced into an awkward position, because I think they do know that the law says it's lawful to help people on the Sabbath. And so they've been getting on him all this time about it. And so I think they're kind of trapped, and that's how they respond. He says, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? It says, but they remain silent. So he's like, well, you're not going to say anything. I'm going to go ahead and do what I always do. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, if one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out? And they had nothing to say. And one of the reasons for that is because this is specific Levitical law. They already know that is not only allowed, you're obligated to help your neighbor and help yourself and help your children and help your animals. This is the kind of thing that there's no question about. So he kind of heads off the usual argument about healing on the Sabbath right at the beginning. Before he heals the guy, he kind of tacks it head on, and there is no argument. There's no answer. That's just a little story about when they didn't argue with him about it. It goes on in verse 7. It says, when he noticed how the guests, so this is the same visit, he's still there. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, so they go in and they're all reclining at the table and they all pick their places. And the honored spots are to the right and the left of the host. Whoever the host is would be honored by sitting on the right and the left. Those are the honored places. And so a lot of people are selecting those places up closest to the host, near the head of the table. And then it gets less important as you go down to the foot. So he kind of watches them kind of scrambling to place themselves in places of honor. So this sounds like it's a fairly big party, right? This is not just Jesus there. He's there. He's been invited, but there's a lot of people there. It says, when he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. Now, this is interesting. He's actually, last week, he told three sheep pen parables, which were all slightly different. One, he was a shepherd, one, he was the gate, and one, he was specifically a good shepherd willing to lay down his life. He's going to do something similar here. He's going to get a three for the price of one parable here, too. He's going to talk about what being guests at a table, at a meal, at a banquet, but he's going to kind of tell three different parables about that. He's going to get a lot of mileage out of this one moment. And again, as we've talked about a lot, notice that this isn't just a parable or a teaching that he came to the Pharisee's house prepared to give. He is, as he often is, discipling by the things that are around him. He's responding to the curriculum of life itself. And so the teaching he's giving, the parable he's sharing, is about an actual event that's happening right in front of them. It becomes bigger as he turns it into a story, but that's obviously coming from watching them vie for the place of honor. So he says, when someone invites you to a wedding feast, it's kind of funny, this is called a parable. It sounds a little more straightforward, but I guess it is because he's gonna give a picture of what the host says. He says, when someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. I guess because it's a wedding feast. We don't know. This may or may not be a wedding feast. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. For a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So, there's a practical lesson as well as the more important spiritual lesson. The practical lesson is don't presume where you belong at the table. Let someone exalt you rather than exalt yourself, just because that's less humiliating. But I think the more spiritual example is that is sort of the way life works too, that those who exalt themselves, you know, pride comes before a fall. Those who exalt themselves and make themselves look better are sort of destined to be humbled. But those who recognize their place in life and where they are in relation to God and really, you know, don't think too highly of themselves are more likely to be exalted by others. My dad used to kind of focus on the practical end of this a lot. Not I don't even think this specifically, but he was very often saying to me and living as an example this truth that if you have to tell people how good you are at something, there's a good chance you're not as good as you think you are. And it's better to not be telling people how good you are and let someone else tell you how good you are. And that's a little bit of what Jesus is saying here. So it's just basically a lesson on humility. Stop vying for the place of honor, because the best you'll either look foolish and humiliated when you're told you can't sit there. And even if you were supposed to be there and you sat there, yeah, that's still not a great look. And so better to, you know, not presume that you deserve the honor and kind of let it be given to you if you do. Then he goes on and gives another example. Then Jesus said to the host. So he says that to everyone there. Then he turns to the host and says to him, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers, your sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. This reminds me of times when Jesus says something like, if you love your neighbor, how is that different from anyone else? And that's kind of what he's saying here, is that, you know, when you invite someone to dinner that can invite you back, you're not doing a service to anybody. You're just playing a quid pro quo game. So he says, if you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So this has shades of things he's told the Pharisees before. That what is it you're looking for? Are you looking to be esteemed and rewarded in this life? Well, then that may be what you get. Or are you looking to actually love people and not do things for the reward you get here? Because if you do, there is justice. God will see what you do, and he will reward you eternally, more significantly in heaven. And so that's the point here. He's saying, yeah, I see that you've invited all these really important people. That's nice. But what if you invited the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, which is a huge ask. I mean, again, just think about, where do we usually see the crippled, the poor, the blind, and the lame in these stories? They're usually begging. They're not being invited to dinners. And so he's really challenging them. You know, approach the world differently. Don't just be nice to people that can be nice to you back. Try being nice to people that cannot repay you. Try being nice to people because you should be, and even if they can't repay you. And then he goes on, he gives a third parable about the banquet. He says, when one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." So I don't know if they're trying to deflect a little bit by over-spiritualizing it, by saying, oh yeah, you're talking about the kingdom of God's feast, and that's different than an actual feast. Or if they're just, you know, taking what he's saying and running with it. I'm not sure exactly what their motivation is, but here's Jesus' response to them. Jesus replied. So now he's talking about what the kingdom of God is like, I think, in response to what this guy said. A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, "Come, for everything is now ready." But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, "I've just bought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me." Another said, "I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me." Still another said, "I just got married, so I can't come." The servant came back and reported this to his master. You'll notice all of these explanations or excuses, and the one I'm most sympathetic to is the married one, but still, all of these are things that they've been invited to dinner. They haven't been asked to go overseas and leave. I mean, they can try their oxen out tomorrow. They can look at the field tomorrow. You know, the marriage one, you know, it's a little harder because when you first get married, you're supposed to have a certain amount of time with them in the Jewish custom. But still, even there, I think the point is they're minimizing what the invitation really is, because they are rich, because they are already important people. When they're invited to this banquet, it's just not that important. They're like, "Yeah, we can go to a banquet anytime." Instead of saying, "I can go see my field another time," they're like, "I can go to the banquet anytime." I think one way to think of it is if the president of the United States invited you to dinner at the White House, odds are, regardless of whether you like the president or not, odds are that most people would put aside whatever they were doing at that evening to go have dinner with the president. They would see that as a big enough deal, even if it's just a great story to tell the grandkids. They would see it as a big enough deal to go do that, and everything else would get put on hold for that evening. And I think that's what he's saying. You know, there's a great man, but when he invited all these people, they had other things that were more important to them. So the servant came back and reported this to the master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, "Go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame." So now this guy is doing what Jesus said, you know, you should do anyway. But in this case, it's a slightly different point. "Sir," the servant said, "what you ordered has been done, but there is still room." So he goes out and invites all those people, but there was just so much room at this banquet, at this feast, that they couldn't even fill it up with those people. But the implication is that all those people came. And again, it makes sense. It's not that their lives aren't important, but they see things differently. They've been invited to a feast, and the feast they've been invited to has a different place of priority in their mind because they're not out there with fields and oxen and wives. They see, they understand the value of what they're being offered. So they jump at it. They come right away. But there's still not enough. There's still room left at the table. So then the master told his servant, "Go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet." So this latter part is a little peculiar. And if you take this allegory in the wrong direction, it's weird. I don't think God compels anybody to join the kingdom of God. That's pretty clear. But I think the point here is that in this story, the banquet host, he just wants to make sure that those who rejected him don't get to come. He's like, "I don't want to leave space for them to decide when it's on their good time, they can come." He wants to make sure that he's just going to invite everybody else. And even if it means forcing people to come, he's going to fill it with anybody who will come, except for the people who just rejected him and refused to come. And there's a lot of things about this story that we know in hindsight. Again, what are they seeing about this? I think they're seeing a question about priority. Again, Jesus calls the Pharisees many times. And a lot of times they're like, "Yeah, you're not that important. We have more important things. Our authority, our power, our wealth, our enrichment is more important than what you're doing." And so it's a little bit, it's a them. He's like, "Is that right? Are you sure about that? Are you sure that when you turn me down, you want to do that? Because I'll invite other people." But it's also the answer to the question they always ask. Why are you always inviting the crippled and the lame and the blind? Why do you spend so much time inviting them to the kingdom? And part of his answer is, "I have invited you as well. But you don't want to come. These guys want to come because they recognize their need. It's back to that idea that I'm here for the sick, but you say you're not sick, so you won't come. I've invited you to the banquet, but you say you don't need it, so you don't come. But the people who do need it, who recognize they need it, they come. So don't ask me why that's happening. There is also, for us, in hindsight, there are things that Paul talks about in that when Jesus came, and again, the plan was always to include all nations. We know that. That's been prophesied, and Jesus makes that clear. But there is sort of an order to the way things go. And Paul talks about it, that when Jesus came, he invited the Jews, and the many Jews came, but many did not. Many rejected him. And so Paul becomes a minister to the Gentiles. It expands, and he goes out to the Gentiles, which is kind of an unbelievable thing for the Jews to see, that the Jewish Messiah is actually everybody's Messiah. And so there may be sort of a little description of that unfolding here as well, that Jesus is acknowledging, you know, in the banquet in the kingdom of heaven, there's the Gentile, the Jews that are invited and reject, and then we turn to the Gentiles. Again, I think if you see it that way, you have to understand it's not saying that Jesus only went to the Gentiles out of vengeance or pettiness or because he was mad at the Jews rejected him. It's just kind of a allegory that shows historically what happened, but the motivations for Jesus are different than the ones for this banquet owner. So that's kind of what's going on there. So I see your hand, Meredith, and then anybody else who has comments or thoughts on these banquet parables or the one before. Go ahead, Meredith, what's up?
Well, like in the epistles, or I don't know, I guess maybe in the gospels, isn't there one about like, it talks about like kind of grafting the like Gentiles in, like with the tree, and then it like makes like, in some ways it makes like the Jews like jealous into and seeing them offer that. Not that he doesn't just want to do that anyway.
Yes, that's Paul. Paul, that's part of where Paul does talk about that it was offered to the Jews first.
Okay.
They rejected it, then the Gentiles, but then he does explain the Gentiles are as those grafted in. So there's some interesting ways, and it's worth for the details waiting until we get to Paul, because there is a lot of nuance to it, because he does make a distinction between Jews and Gentiles on the one hand, and then in the other hand, he says they're the same. And it's really important to kind of understand in what ways they're different and what ways they're same. But you're right. He talks about that, and then even talks about the fact that as the Gentiles come to the church, it then brings more Jews in because they're jealous of what's happening with the Gentiles. Or it appears he might be saying that as well. So I think that's what you're alluding to. That's in Romans.
Yeah. Well, and I could kind of see like maybe like here to the idea of, you know, he wants everybody to come. So he's like kind of doing whatever he can to get them there. And I mean, and it does say he is a jealous God, you know, and so if that, you know, kind of makes them like jealous and look into it more, I mean, great.
Sure. The difference is that at the end of this parable, the host says they will never get a taste of my banquet. So,
well, yeah, it's all
different. Trying to lure them back in. But again, that's the thing. A parable is not an allegory. The host doesn't have to be an exact replica of God, and his motivations can be different. And that's often true of parables, I think, in fact. But yeah, I can see some commonality there with
what. Well, yeah, and I'm sure he's sharing that with them now, not to be like, okay, you guys don't get to come. You know, I'm sure it's to kind of, you know, spark some interest, hopefully.
For sure. That makes sense. Yep. Lauren, you turned on your video. Is that because you were going to say something?
Yeah. It's interesting too, because we can see at this point that Jesus has kind of, in a lot of ways, delivered his primary messages. And so now he's just reiterating them in different ways. Like, this is all very reminiscent of the Beatitudes, that stuff about humility. It's not the way you think it is. Power doesn't look like what you think it looks like. And then also that the idea that we saw, especially early in his ministry, of access is for everyone. And even maybe not especially the people that you don't think of, but they're better able to see it and receive it because they don't already think that they have all the access they need. And so it is interesting. He just is sort of coming at similar things from different angles to try and get the point across.
That's good. Yeah, I think that's very true and well said. Anybody else have any thoughts on these parables?
I actually was also thinking how this kind of ties in with your teaching series right now about especially the first one that you're talking about with the seats at the was that the seats at the wedding feast, or I don't remember if it was wedding or not, but the seats at the feast where don't take the choice seat because someone more important than you might be the one that's supposed to be in that seat. Yeah. And that kind of reminded me of the messages of you know, being softer and being quieter, because if you're loud or fast or going at something hard because of pride, then you might get reality check every once in a while, because you might not be as in certain situations, you may not be as, you know, important as you think you are, or, you know, yeah, to, you know, a certain individual or whatever that case may be. But
no, I think you're right. And I think they both point out how countercultural it is for us, because this message, even don't take the place of honor. You know, this sounds to us in our culture, I could hear people saying that sounds disingenuous, or I could hear people saying you're worth what you're willing to put forward. You know, you're not branding yourself well if you sit at the wrong end of the table. I can hear all sorts of messages that people would give where they would say what's really important is to make sure that you're seen for the value you have, that you're paid for what you're worth, that you market yourself as a right-hand man guy and not the guy who sits at the end of the table. I can see people saying the opposite of what Jesus is saying here. And we can have a discussion about when or when that isn't appropriate, but we have to acknowledge that what Jesus is saying here is real. And it appears to be pretty countercultural to the very specific branding, marketing ourselves, you know, as the best self that we are. There's something about that that does not resonate, doesn't fit with what he's sharing here. So I think that's good, Jolene. I think that's the sense in which it is similar to the messages that we've been talking about for those of you who are at Focus, which I recognize is not everybody in this room, so we don't have to go too far into that. Lauren, you had another thought?
Yeah, I think too that on the other hand, there is something fairly just sort of almost like a proverb that this is just in many ways the way things work to it as well. This idea that the people who spend the most time trying to exalt themselves aren't actually doing the things that result in being exalted, right? If you spend all your time telling people how great you are, which you kind of talked about as well, you let other people tell you, then it's just not going to happen. But the people who really have that seat at the head aren't worried about it. So they're not jockeying for that position. They're minding their own business. They're doing what they need to do. And that's what's going to result in them getting called up, not trying to fight for that perception.
That's good. Yeah, that's really good. Good. In the next thing that Jesus talks about, it says large crowds were traveling with Jesus. So we're now outside of the house. We've now moved on. But either Jesus has in mind, or at least Luke does in the way he combines these stories, the part of what he's about to do now is also, it has some echo. It's echoing a little bit the Kingdom of Heaven story that he shared, where people were called to come to the banquet and they decided other things were more important. Because what Jesus is about to do, and again, as Lauren pointed out, this is messages he's been giving now for a few weeks, so he is reiterating. But what he's about to do is say, don't just follow me on a whim, because if you do, it's not going to be worth it. Because if you do, you're going to want to go back to your field. You're going to want to go back to your, you know, to your oxen, you know, really consider that when you come follow me, it's going to be costly. And this also, you know, goes back to the fact that Jesus spends a lot of time in his last days sort of preaching crowds away. and that's a little bit what he's doing here. And I think his point isn't that, you know, it's not worth it. He said many times it's worth it, but his point is, do you know it's worth it? You know, have you really considered whether following me is worth it? Because if you're just following me for free bread, or you're just following me because I'm fashionable right now, which he is, or if you're just following me because I'm kind of a big polarizing figure right now, which he is, then you're going to find out in a little bit here when I die that it wasn't worth it. That you're not going to hang in there. You're gonna decide at that point you shouldn't have given up what you gave up to follow me. So you need to know the value. You need to know the cost of discipleship, and then you need to know the value of discipleship. You need to decide if it's worth it to you. And I think the answer is always it is worth it, but it's only worth it if you know it, if you know what it is you're actually pursuing. You know, is what does it mean to follow Jesus? If it's just popularity, if it's just comfort, then that's not gonna last and it's not gonna be worth it. So that's kind of where we go now. And here's what he says. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, and yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. Clearly, he's not into people hating their family members, nor is he into people actually despairing of their own life. But it is this point that he's made several times, that I'm offering you actual life, and I'm offering you, you know, eternity, and I'm offering you this amazing feast. And if everything else doesn't pale in comparison to that, to such a degree that we can, for the moment, in hyperbole, and I think Jesus, we know, is not above hyperbole. This is hyperbole. But if we can kind of hyperbolically say, you know, in comparison to your devotion to me, it's like you hate all these other things in your life, everything else about your life, then you're gonna find out it wasn't worth it. This is how devoted he says, I'm actually calling you to be. In the same way that he's been really pushing the envelope and saying, I am God. You need to decide. I'm telling you I'm God. I'm telling you I'm the Messiah. You can't waffle. You need to decide. I am or I'm not. If I'm not, don't follow me, because it's not worth it. If I am, I am. In the same way, he's saying to them, if you aren't willing to consider that I am God and worthy of all devotion, then don't bother, because that is what I'm calling. His call is getting bigger and bigger as he gets closer and closer to his death. He says, whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. At this point, it's not clear to them he's going to die on a cross. Very few of them have heard that at all. And those who have seem to forget it every time he says it, like legitimately, because it's too awkward. But they do understand what it means to carry your cross. They know that many people who are crucified are forced to carry their own cross, their own instrument of death, with them up to the hill, at which point then they are nailed to that cross. Or at least to the cross beam, which is what it actually is. And Jesus will ultimately not be able to carry his own cross because he is too weak. But they know that typically that's what people do. So they understand that he's talking about morbid, terrible things. The idea of carrying your own cross does mean being willing to be, you're on your way to be crucified. So again, very strong statement. He's not mincing words. But again, he knows where he's going. He knows that in just a couple weeks, this is it. He's done. And if people aren't devoted to him, they're going to wonder why on earth they gave things up to follow him. And that's all he's saying. I don't want you to wonder. This is what I'm calling. It is big. I'm calling it big thing. And then he goes on. So suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. How confident are you that you want to build this tower with me? Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. Ultimately, this is what it will mean. There is also a practical point to this. Once he dies, very short order, it does not become fun to be a follower of Jesus. It becomes scary. It becomes, you know, it's going to be very legitimately true for them that they're going to be in the middle of something and they're going to ask themselves, is it worth it? And I really think Jesus' point isn't to scare them into thinking it's not worth it. I think his point is to get them to consider it now, so that when they face those moments, they'll say, I already know this is worth it. I'm glad I made that decision ahead of time. I know that my very life is worth pressing on. And that's certainly the attitude that the apostles did end up having. So I think that's the call he's giving them. Luke has Jesus at this moment, this statement. And again, I don't think Luke is making up what Jesus says, but I think the things he leaves out, the things he adds have to do with what Luke is interested in as an agenda. And I say all that to say, I'm not sure exactly how this exactly flows from the previous verses, but there's some sort of intuitive connection to me. He says, salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? I think the point being there again, that if you have decided already that I'm worth it, if you've decided that I am life, all these things that John said, if you have decided I am life and I am the good shepherd and I will lay my life down for you and I am the resurrection and I am the way and I am the truth, if you've decided all those things are, and I am God, if you've decided all those things are true and therefore I really am worth everything, then you won't get in the middle of building the tower and then stop. And I think the point is that would sort of be like salt that's not salty. It's like your whole purpose is to make food salty. Your whole purpose is to be, and then that affects things. And if you aren't, if you've decided your purpose is not worth it anymore, well, then it's really hard to come back from that. Where do you go from there? So I think that's sort of the intuitive connection. It says it is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown out. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear. This is a hard message to hear. So that's why I think Jesus is saying, just think about it. Think about what I'm saying and decide to you if it's worth it. You know, Hebrews later talks about that with Christianity, if you taste the gospel, if you get a hint of it and you reject it, you say, nope, Jesus isn't what I want. There's just nothing else to come back to. I mean, you can come back to Jesus, but that would be to overturn what you just rejected. And that's harder to do. And I think the author of Hebrews says that, that, you know, when you've tasted it and then rejected it, it's harder to come back, not because Jesus won't welcome you, but because you've rejected the one thing you're looking for. Well, how, what do you do about that? Now, what do? You have to completely change your mind to that, which you can. But I think the point is that's a lot harder to do at that point. And I think Jesus is saying the same thing. Before you get halfway in, then think maybe it's not worth it because it was harder than you thought. Then it'll be harder to come back after that. Decide now. Look at it now. Really listen to me. Look at me. Am I everything I say I am? And if I'm not, do not come. If I am, then come with everything you've got and don't hold anything back. So I think that's kind of the point of that. Any thoughts on that? Those, some of those hard messages there.
It is so counter-human. Like all of it. Like, no, I was just like thinking too, like we accept it more easily, but I don't know. We've heard it a lot, you know, and just there, it's not surprising that they would need to hear it like over and over again. And each time it might still be kind of like, wait, oh, okay, that kind of makes sense, you know, but it's just so like the kingdom of heaven, the contrast of like earth and like the kingdom of heaven is just so, it's like Jesus is like going against the grain like all the time.
Yep. No, I think you're right. And it is easy. You're right. It's easy for us to, well, it's almost like we've gone through a cycle where we now not only have become so used to the words of Jesus, we don't recognize how radical they are. That would be one thing if we were living them out and just not seeing that they were radical because they were part of our internalized life. But it's now like we've kind of come full circle now. You know, I think in America in general, even in the American church to some degree, we've come full circle to a point now where we don't recognize how radical they are, but it's because we don't want to be that radical anymore. It's because we want to be radical in different ways. And I think we do miss how valuable and significant, how much he's talking about life and everything that we want being in him. I think we don't always believe that anymore. And so we hear these radical messages and we water them down in our brain instead of realizing, no, that is a big call. It is a big call. And again, connected to a lot of the fact that I don't think we remember how worth it is, you know, how worthy it is and how much that he is the good shepherd who's laid down his life for us. That's always an important part of the message. We're going to come back to that message too. Jesus gives the hard challenge, but he always connects it with the incredible value of what we are pursuing or should be pursuing. Yeah. Luke chapter 15, he says this, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered. Before we even go on, again, this is the living out of what he keeps saying. Why do the sinners and tax collectors gather around to hear him, even when he says hard things like this? Well, because their lives are already hard. For them, giving up what their life is in order to receive something better isn't as hard to believe could be the case as it is for someone whose life is already pretty good. For them, there's a risk it gets worse. For the tax collectors and sinners, they're kind of like, you know, I'm not that happy anyway. I already know I'm not doing well. I already know that I'm poor. I already know that I'm miserable. So it's easier, I think, in that sense for them to say, yeah, I'll give up my life to go for something better. But for those who have this place of power and position, sometimes they don't see that. It's as true for them. They also are in need of something much, much better. But they just have learned how to sort of cover it up in their own heads. Because they've gained so much of what the world thinks of as happiness and good. So it says the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. All right. as a response to that, once again, as Lorraine said, saying things he's said before, right? This is not a new complaint. Why are you hanging out with sinners and tax collectors? Why are you hanging out with the dregs of society? Why are you hanging out with all the, just really the whatever, you know, whatever to you would be the people that are kind of most uncomfortable to hang out with? Why are you hanging out with the homeless guys on the corner? You know, why are you hanging out with the gang members in the downtown or whatever? You know, why are you hanging out with the people that people don't hang out with? And he's answered this question a lot. And it does always come back to, because they know their need and they know they're sick. And I'm here for those who are sick. Why don't I hang out with you? Which he does, by the way. But why does it look to you like you don't hang out with you? Because you keep telling me you don't need me. Because when I do hang out with you, you keep telling me I'm not worth the cost. You aren't going to build that tower with me. You don't want to. So he's going to tell three stories, though, to explain the heart of Jesus, which is the best thing about these stories, is that they remind us what it means that Jesus is the good shepherd. And it's because he's the good shepherd that he hangs out with the people he hangs out with. And the first one, he says this, then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. And then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep. I tell you to them, in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. There's so many layers to this story, but the heart of Jesus is very clear. He's saying, look, if I've got truly 100 sheep and they're all safe and one of them wanders off, is lost, of course, it's not that I don't care about the 99, but they're safe. So I'm going to go out and rescue the one that needs to be rescued. I'm going to go out and get the one that isn't safe. And when I find him, of course, we're all going to rejoice because he was lost, but now he's found. And that's especially joyful. Doesn't mean he doesn't care about the other sheep. So he's saying, why am I with the sinners and tax collectors? Even the most generous understanding, even if you as a Pharisee want to cling to your idea of your own righteousness, you should at least understand that, of course, if you're safe, I'm going to go off after those that aren't. So why are you worried about it? But that's where the other layer comes in, because we know they're not really righteous and they are in need of repentance. But there is this sense that if they knew that, they wouldn't be asking about Jesus. And if they really thought they were righteous and didn't need Jesus, they also wouldn't be asking him why he's hanging out with them. They would just say, well, of course he hangs out with them because they need him more than we do. It is like they're in this in-between where they're actually kind of aware that they need help, but they aren't ready to admit that they're aware they need help. And so they're bugged by the fact that he's spending time with people who are so open about needing help, when they themselves also need help. And then you get people like Nicodemus who show up to Jesus in the middle of the night, basically saying, I need help, but I'm not sure how to express it. And Jesus kind of walks him through that. But the picture here, the message, the parable here isn't about the sheep. It isn't about the good sheep and the bad sheep. It's about the love of Jesus. It's about the love of God, that he's going to go after those who need help and those who aren't safe. He's going to go rescue them. He cares about them. And it's not a matter of numbers. So what if he's got 99 sheep? It's one that's the missing one he's got to get. The 99 are safe. If 99 wandered away, he'd also look for them. But it's just one. And then he tells another story, which is the same story. He says, or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her neighbors and friends together and says, rejoice with me, I found my lost coin. In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. This woman recognizes the value of her coins. The 9 coins she still has their value. She still values them. She still loves them. She'd be devastated if she lost those other 9, but she didn't lose those other 9. She still got them. So what is she worried about? What does she spend her time doing? She's going to search the whole house until she finds that missing coin. And when she does, she's so excited to have found that one coin, not because the one coin is more valuable than the other 9, but because it was lost. It was a value that was lost, and now it's retrieved. And here again, Jesus is saying, this is how it is in heaven. We look out there and we say, in theory, here's all these righteous people. Here's all these people that don't need redemption. Fantastic. They're safe. We value them. They're here. But the value that's lost is all those unredeemed humans. The value that's lost is all those unrepentant people. The value that's lost is all those people out there that aren't being in the care and love of God, so their value can be realized. So what do? We find them. And every time we find one of those, every time we redeem a lost soul, the heaven says that's a value that's been returned. That's a coin that's been recollected. That's a sheep that's been protected. It's a huge thing. And again, it's on the Pharisees as he tells these stories to decide where they reside. They could say to Jesus at this moment, actually, you know what? I'm that lost sheep. I wish you'd spend time with me. And you, I guarantee you, Jesus would say, absolutely. What time do you need? let's figure this out. You're telling me you need help. I'm delighted to help you. You know, but they don't. Mostly they just say, yeah, that's weird. We don't need you, but we don't understand why you're with people who say they do. And then we get to the third story. And it's really important to recognize this is the third story of three stories. It's the same story. It's more developed. There's a little bit more detail. We get a subplot, a plot B, if you will, that's relevant. But it's important to recognize it's still the same story. So this is the story that we sometimes call the prodigal son. I don't like calling it the prodigal son only because it misplaces the important character in the story. We shouldn't, although we might, call the other parables the parable of the lost coin and the lost sheep. We could call it that, but we understand that those parables aren't about the coin and the sheep. They're about the woman who searches for the coin. They're about the shepherd who finds the sheep. In the same way, this story is not about the son. It's about the father. It's about the father's heart. It's about the fact how happy he is to find the lost one. And so I think it's important to read this story that way, because that really is, it's paired that way with these other two, and that's the essence. We get more story, we get more development, so it's easy to think it's about what the son does. It's really not, though. It's really about the father and his reaction to finding his son, just as the lost coin is about the reaction to finding the coin, and the lost sheep is the reaction to finding the lost sheep. So let's read it. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off to a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And after he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. And he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything." So again, more developed, but it's the same setup. In the first story, you have 99 sheep who stay and one who leaves and gets in trouble. In the coin, you have 9 coins that are staying. They're still in the possession of the woman, and one that gets lost. In this story, you have one brother that stays and one that goes off and gets lost. "When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father." One of the reasons it's easy to think this is a story about the son is because it's his point of view at this point, right? We're seeing him come to the repentance, the moment of repentance. I think the reason we get more development is because when you're not talking about sheep and coins, you do have the question, like he's posing to the Pharisees by implication, of do you recognize your own need? The sheep doesn't have to recognize his own need and is probably too dumb to do so. The coin is absolutely too dumb, literally, to recognize its need to be with other coins. But the human can recognize it. And that's part of what it means to be not lost or to recognize your need. So that's why we get that. But the other reason is it's kind of cool by giving us the son's perspective. There's suspense about what the father's response will be. The son isn't completely sure what the father's response will be. The best he can come up with is, even the hired hands do better than I do, so maybe I can at least be that. He's not expecting to be welcomed back with open arms and joy and rejoicing. Now, if we've been paying attention to the other two parables, we should know that's what's coming. But by putting it in the prodigal son's point of view, that's kind of the nice suspense we get. We get that tension that he feels of, what will the father's response be? But I think the implication is, just like the shepherd and just like the woman, the father's response has already been happening. He's already been looking for his son. And the next sentence kind of reveals that. It says, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. Why did his father see him when he was still a long way off? Because his father had been looking for him. Like the woman was looking for the coin, like the shepherd is looking for the sheep. His father was, you know, going out every day, if you will, and gazing the horizon, hoping his son would return. Famine hit the land, and he thought, my son's out there by himself. He should come home. I hope he does. and he's looking for him. He's actively looking for him. And because of that, he sees him when he's a long way off. And it says, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. I really love also, again, there's this dual thing, but for the parable's sake, the point of the parable, the father doesn't really know the nature of his son's repentance, except that his son is coming back. He sees his son returning, and that's all he needs. He runs to him. He doesn't wait to hear how sorry the son is or how much he deserved to, you know, did he really spend his money wisely and he just got in trouble and it wasn't his own fault. He doesn't care about any of that. He's not interested in what the son deserved or didn't deserve. He just sees that his son is headed his direction, and he runs to meet him and throws his arms around him and kisses him. So he alleviates that tension as soon as he can, as quickly as he's able to. As soon as he sees the son, he removes from his son the question, the doubt, the tension, the suspension about how will my father feel about me coming home. His son didn't even get to make his prepared speech yet about, I just want to be a hired hand. He didn't get to make that because his father already welcomed him as a son. The son, he tries to make the speech now. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. I love the fact that the father actually just kind of ignores that statement. He doesn't argue with him. He just, the next statement he says shows that he's not listening or doesn't care or doesn't agree. Because it says, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. You don't do these things for your hired hands. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. So his son says, I'm not worthy to be your son. And his father simply says, look, my son is here. Like, don't know what you're saying, son. It's irrelevant because you're my son. He was lost and is found. And so they begin to celebrate. And so we have the same elements. It's the same parable. Again, the father is seeking the son. When he finds the lost son, he rejoices. What's interesting is the parable is also developed more because now, because they're humans and not sheep and coins, we do get to hear how the other sheep, you know, respond to the one coming back. It's like the other 99, if they saw how much joy there was over the one, and they're like, well, what are we? We've been here the whole time. You know, if the other coins had emotions and said, why did you care about that one coin? We're worth nine times as much as that coin. You know, that you can, with humans, you can kind of get into that a little bit. And because the Pharisees are who he's speaking to, at least in part, this is how they feel. This is their question. This is where the essence of their question is coming from. Why do you spend time with them? It's a little bit of the same jealousy that we're going to see the brother feels. And so that's what happens. It says, meanwhile, the older son was in the field. Where was he? He was in the pen with the sheep. Where was he? He was with the other coins in the pocket or the purse. Where was he? He was in the field with his dad. He had never left. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. And the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So now the older brother's like, I don't want to be part of this celebration because I'm upset. So his father went out and pleaded with him. Now, this is fascinating to me too. Don't miss the point that even though the Pharisees are the so-called bad guys in this story, the father also goes looking for him when he refuses to come. Do you see that? The prodigal son leaves and the father's looking for him. Then the older son, so-called not prodigal son, he also refuses to come in, right? He's kind of leaving and the father goes out and pleads with him. Now he's the missing one that the father goes to. So there is an irony here that the older brother doesn't even see that the father is doing exactly for him what he did for the younger son. So the father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Now, this does tell you about how the son sees his relationship with his father, and it's not a great picture. And I don't think that's the father's fault, but it's just how he's resentful of the work he's put in. He hasn't been doing it because he feels like he belongs there the way the younger son now feels like he wants to come. He says, I've been slaving for you, never disobeyed your orders, yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. Maybe true, maybe not. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes come home, you kill the fattened calf for him. Fattened calf for him. And this is where Jesus is answering the Pharisees. They're like, we've been serving God for years, and now you're spending all your time with sinners and tax collectors. And it's as if Jesus is answering them the same way that he would answer the son. My son, the father said, you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this father of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. There is a value in the fact that he's come home. You already have everything I have. He took a piece of my inheritance and left and spent it all. But you have continued to benefit from my continued prosperity. You have always had, maybe I didn't give you a goat for your friends, but we eat fat and calf all the time. You know, we're together all the time. We have dinner all the time. And that doesn't make it less valuable, but it means, why is it less valuable to you? Why are you not seeing that? So again, it's incumbent upon the Pharisees. They have a choice to make. They either say, oh, we've been serving God all these years and Jesus is right. We have received all the blessings that come from serving God because our authority is legitimate, because we truly are righteous, because we are where we should be. We have enjoyed being in God's family. And therefore, why are we upset that he's spending time with the lost sons and the lost coins and the lost sheep? That would be one option. Or the other option is to say, oh, actually, we've been lost too. I realize now that as we've been serving God, we haven't been serving God. We haven't enjoyed it. Hasn't been like we belonged in the family. We aren't experiencing the blessings God keeps promising. So we must be lost as well. So we're one of the same people that he wants to hang out with. But instead, they keep choosing this really unhealthy middle ground where they claim that they're righteous and serving God, but they're unhappy about it. And therefore, they don't understand why he's spending time with other people. They want to say they don't need Jesus, but at the same time, they know they do. And so they're kind of stuck in the middle. And I think that's what Jesus is trying to shake them out of, to say, I will always give up everything for the lost son, the lost sheep, the lost coin, to bring him back. And if you tell me you're not one of those, then don't be upset that I'm not pouring my energy there. But at the same time, Jesus is like the father is with his older son. He's constantly going outside and pleading with the Pharisees. He's constantly going to them and saying, come on, recognize that either I've been with you the whole time and you know that I'm God, and so we shouldn't be having these arguments, or recognize that you haven't known who God is, and that's okay too, because I'm here for you. So I think they're beautiful stories which affirm Jesus' heart to seek and save the lost, but also give every person a chance to see themselves in that position, and know that God is out there looking for them, and it's just up to them if they're willing to be, you know, that squandering son, or to recognize their own squandering habits, whatever that is, for them to recognize their own lostness, and that's kind of where they are. So that's the end of chapter 15. Any comments, thoughts, or ideas on anything, including that last set of parables?
Well, I think it's interesting that he ends without giving any kind of response from the other son, because he really is throwing it back to the Pharisees to
that's respond. Good. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. That's a very sort of Jewish way to do it too, right? Where you just tell part of the story because the listener fills in what happens at the end of that story. Yeah. How do you respond to that? That's really good. I hadn't even thought about that, but I think you're exactly right.
I love the example that, like, with Jesus is telling this, and it's like from God. And I love that, like, the prodigal son, he didn't even like, I mean, his need was so like, not, and so like, I mean, since Jesus is saying that, he knows that, he's the one telling the parable, but like, the need was so not even really like needy. I mean, it was more like, this seems better than what I had before. And like, that's enough, like, for God. He just like wants us that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really like
that. The nature of repentance is shallow and selfish. But I think that is the truth for all of us. At least when we first get saved, it's usually shallow and selfish. And I think God is like, that's all you can manage right now. I get it. It's going to take a while for me to help turn you into someone who's not completely shallow and selfish. So that's okay. I'll take what I can get. I think you're right about that. I think there's a lot to
that. Yeah. Well, I guess too, like, I mean, the older son too, because he's like out there throwing like a temper tantrum.
Yes.
And yeah, like, you know, and he like goes out to him and tries to reason with him.
He does. And I love that. I love the fact that there's that little tidbit that he goes to him too. He didn't ignore him. He didn't dismiss him.
Yeah.
He pleaded with him, right? He pleaded with him. I don't plead with my temper tantrum kids usually, you know, but this is a father is. He's like pleading with him. He's like, come on, just come inside. And I think that is because that is what he's doing with the Pharisees. all these conversations he's having with them, he's pleading with them. He's like, well, come. I imagine it's like, why are you hanging out with tax collectors and sinners? And part of what Jesus wants to say is, come join the party. Just come inside and eat the fatted calf with us. Why are you upset that we're doing this? You can be part of it. No one's excluding you. You're just excluding yourself. I love that he's kind of making that clear to the Pharisees. And then, as Lorraine says, he just leaves the story there. So they have to kind of decide, what do we do with that? What are we supposed to do with that story? Because are we righteous? Well, then he's right. Why are we complaining? And if we're not righteous, then he's also right. We should be at the party. Either way, we should be at the party. There's really no reason to stand outside and whine. And I think he makes that point really effectively. But I do love the fact that this whole series, you know, starting in chapter 14, starts with him eating in the house of a Pharisee. Because as much contention as there is between them, as much tension as there is, as much as they are constantly watching him and trying to trap him, he keeps coming back to him. And he keeps pleading with them as much as he does with anybody. It's just that they're the least responsive to his pleas. The sinners and tax collectors tend to be responsive to his pleas, but these Pharisees just aren't. But he doesn't quit trying.
Yeah. And the prodigal son, I mean, it's such like a gentle, like pleading with them too. It's not like a big, like in your face, like, you know, type thing.
One of my contemporary heroes of the Christian faith, a man who seems to have held his integrity and faithfulness for 80 some years, just died in the last couple of weeks. Some of you may know him. He's famous. His name is Tim Keller, and he wrote a book called The Prodigal Father, which you guys might pick up if you're interested. He's a very smart guy, and he understands the heart of God well. I really like the way he writes. So if you're interested in his thoughts on this parable and other things, you can pick it up by Tim Keller. Other thoughts? Sorry, the prodigal God. I said the prodigal father, which makes slightly less sense than the prodigal God, but yes, it's called the prodigal God. Thank you, Lori. All right, well, remember, next week is Memorial Day, and then I'm out of town essentially for the three Mondays after that. I might technically be in town one of those, but I think I'll be pretty exhausted. So 4 weeks, we'll take a break. Enjoy your break. I will come back on I think that means like June 26th, if I remember correctly. So I think that's when we pick back up, is on June 26th. So we will reconvene at that time.
Thank you for joining us. The Journey is a ministry of Discipleship Matters, which is an extension of Focus Church and is created by David McGill for the purpose of helping equip pastors to build discipleship communities in their own churches. If you'd like to learn more about the books and conferences and coaching offered by David, you can check out his website, davidmcgill.com.